Put your flags up in the sky. And we're gonna try to say,
welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. You just heard a cut from the official FIFA World Cup song for 2014. Soccer's premier international event kicked off in Brazil last week, despite protests that brought both chanting and tear gas to the streets. Joining us now by phone from Sao Paulo is new NPR's South American correspondent, Lourdes Garcia Navarro. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So many Brazilians live in poverty. There has been criticism about the money spent on the games. But is that what the main objections are at the protests you've seen?
Absolutely. I mean, we've seen protests and strikes leading up to this World Cup, and they've been pretty diffuse. You've had different groups protesting different things. We had the homeless movement talking about the lack of affordable housing. We've seen policemen talking about the lack of pay and benefits. So there's been different groups using this as an opportunity to raise their concerns with the governments, be it local or federal. And they were successful. Many of them actually managed to get pay rises or promises from the government over housing. But certainly the people that are still out there, and we are seeing protests at almost every game, but the numbers are very small, a few hundred people at most. These are sort of the hardcore protesters who are talking more about the general problems here, about inequality, about all the money that's been spent on these games.
So in effect, I mean, that could be happening in any country around the world. The same sort of taking it out.
It could be happening in any country around the world, sure.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You've reported on the protests and the police response. What have you been seeing as far as how the few hundred that are out there are treated?
Well, I mean, personally, and this is something that we witnessed at the protests that happened on the opening day, the police response has been extremely aggressive. Just for example, when I was at that protest, there were when it started, there were a few dozen people at most, sort of more reporters than protesters, and certainly a lot more police than both of us put together. Mm. And the police were the ones that just started launching tear gas without really any provocation. And then it sort of escalated from there. Two CNN journalists were injured. We saw images of a policeman, you know, putting pepper spray in the eyes of a restrained protester. So, you know, really ugly scenes. And that's pretty much been what we've seen for the past year in terms of how the police has behaved here. One of the main complaints, of course, here in Brazil is that the police does sort of crack down. They act very aggressively when they don't need to.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about soccer this hour by way of the World Cup in Brazil. It got underway last week. My guest is Lourdes Garcia Navarro. She's an NPR South American correspondent. If you have a question or comment about the games down there, give us a call, 614-292-8513. What about the facilities themselves? We've been hearing a lot about how things are just half-built, half-baked, and so on. What has your experience been?
Well, I think there was a lot of discussion, as has happened in other sporting events, about the last-minute preparations here. FIFA World Soccer's World Governing Body called this some of the worst preparations that they'd ever been involved in. And we saw people just until the very last minute, they were sort of fixing up the stadiums, putting in seats, lights. But what's happened, of course, is that once these games have gotten underway, the focus has shifted, which is why I think that both the government and FIFA was just desperately waiting for the kickoff moment, because now it's all about what's happening on the pitch and the glitches that there have been, and there have been some. You know, lights have gone off in certain stadiums. The internet's been terrible in certain stadiums. You know, the cell phone network, as predicted, has not really held up underneath all the visitors here. But, you know, everyone's just talking about the games themselves, and everyone's having a pretty good time. You know, obviously, Brazil is just one of the most beautiful countries in the world. Its people are very hospitable. And so, you know, the people that are coming here to watch football are really willing to shrug off a lot and just enjoy what's happening on the field.
There are several sites around the country, some pretty remote, where the World Cup is taking place. Have you been able to get around and see some of these more remote areas?
I have in the past. Obviously, I'm in Sao Paulo right now, and this has only been going on for, about a week now. But certainly, yeah, I mean, that was one of the big controversies leading up to this, that FIFA only asked that there would be 8 host cities. Brazil decided that there were going to be 12, and they gave them to places like Manaus in the Amazon, in Mato Grosso, Cuiabá. You know, these are places that normally don't see a lot of visitors, certainly don't see events of this scale and size. And so there was a lot of controversy and concern as to whether, you know, these places would be able to hold up under the strain of so many visitors. And then, of course, what will happen afterwards?
Right.
And that's one of the big questions, you know, for many Brazilians here right now. You know, we are seeing these stadiums. They are beautiful. They are cathedrals to the sport. Really, I can't overestimate how stunning they are. And they have the hefty price tags to match. And people are wondering afterwards what is going to happen to them in places like Manaus, in places like Cuiabá, in the state of Mato Grosso. These places do not have local soccer teams that can support these stadiums.
Have the protests, or even the ones that you've described here, just the ones that have they impacted the festivities surrounding the World Cup? Is it something that's noticeable now for most of the people they're visiting?
I mean, I think certainly people are aware in the run-up to the World Cup and now that protests are taking place. But one of the things that has definitely happened is that the police has been acting very aggressively to keep the protests away from the stadiums and away from the fans. So they've been pretty isolated in many ways. I mean, we saw here in Sao Paulo, for example, that the protesters were kept, 5 to 6 miles away from the stadium. Hmm. And so, you're not going to, if you're just taking the metro going to the stadium here to see the opening match, you're not going to necessarily see protesters. So I think, they haven't been noticeable for fans who are coming here, but certainly it's something that Brazilians are taking into account. And we have an election here coming up in October. So what happens during the World Cup, some people say will impact what happens during the elections. But beyond that, a lot of Brazilians that I've spoken to who aren't involved in the protests, they're just regular Brazilians. But they say, this isn't a time for protests. This isn't a time to talk about what's wrong in this country. This is a time to celebrate football, soccer, but that doesn't mean that these problems have gone away. That doesn't mean that we have forgotten what's happened here. It just means that we're going to punish our politicians at the ballot box, not necessarily on the streets.
It does seem like there is more of a national pride component when it comes to something like the Olympics. And you're saying that that's coming out now in Brazil, where people are saying, let's focus on looking good.
Oh, I think that for the rest of the world, the World Cup brings out equally national pride. I mean, this is the biggest sporting event in the world for every country outside of the United States, almost. Mm-hmm. And so it's a huge event, and everyone sort of rallies around their country and their national team. So, what you're seeing here on the streets is just extremely vibrant. You have people here from all over the world carrying their national flags. And, of course, it was extraordinary when Brazil scored its first goal in the opening match. And just the neighborhood that I'm in, I live here, you just heard the shouts coming up from every single house. There wasn't a car on the street. Everyone was watching the game. It is a really big deal here. People take this very seriously, and they're very excited to have this, the World Cup here. What people have explained to me, and I think this is true, the two things aren't exact, they're compatible. You can be disappointed at the way things have gone. You can be disappointed at the money that's been spent, but you can also enjoy the games.
It's the biggest game in the country, right?
Oh, God.
Yeah.
I mean, absolutely. by far. This is just the biggest sport Brazil has. It's the biggest sport in the region. And everyone knows all the team players' names. People have all these superstitions that go along with getting their team to win. They sit on the same chair every time to watch the game. They, carry a specific jersey. They drink a certain beer every time because they don't want to jinx what happens on the field. So this is an enormously powerful spectacle.
Where are all the tourists going? There was one issue about getting the stadiums up and running, but there were other issues about where were people going to stay? How could they possibly build enough hotel rooms and the transportation infrastructure that they would need?
Well, the transportation infrastructure has struggled. There's no doubt about that. We have seen, just going on the metro here in Sao Paulo, that it's just been really overburdened. People have been waiting in long lines to get on. You know, at certain points, the trains have been so crowded that they haven't been able to move. People have had to get off because it's just too many people trying to cram in. But by and large, you know, people are getting to where they need to go despite the delays, and things are sort of proceeding. Like I said, you know, people who travel this far are sort of looking to have a good time, and they're willing to sort of overlook some of the difficulties that you have here. But the cell phone network's been terrible. I've had, you know, our correspondents who are now in Natal, they're there for the U.S. game against Ghana today. Mm-hmm. You know, they've had a lot of problems making phone calls. You know, also our correspondent Tom Goldman had his phone stolen the first day. So, you know, there have been difficulties that we've experienced for ourselves.
Times are hard in Brazil. That's a big reason why this election season coming up is so important. People are frustrated with their politicians there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's obviously at any election, you will talk to people, and that's the time for people to talk about all the things that are wrong in their country and all the things that they'd like to change. But we have seen since last year, when these massive protests broke out in Brazil, a sort of heightened consciousness about all the things that people feel here need to change. You know, there is rampant inequality, prices here are extremely high, and you have a slowing economy. And so all these things put together have made people feel that maybe the direction of the country needs to change, but we still are seeing the president, Dilma Rousseff, the favorite to win the elections. And so it really remains to be seen how this will all play out. But certainly when you speak to people, there is a sense, especially after those protests over the past year, that people really do feel that there is a heightened focus on what needs to be different here in Brazil.
The last time I talked about Brazil was a couple years ago with a journalist. And that back then, Brazil seemed to be on top of the world, one of the fastest growing economies in the world, maybe the fastest growing economy. What's happened in the last few years? Is it just a hangover from the recession or what?
Well, I mean, you know, the economy's changed. You know, the global economy's mm-hmm. changed. You know, Brazil benefited a great deal from actually what was happening in the rest of the world. The fact that Europe was going through a massive crisis, the fact the United States was going through a massive crisis. And so people were looking at emerging markets to put their money. Brazil received a lot of that investment. Also, it was it benefited a lot from China's rapacious need for things like soy and other things that Brazil produces in great quantities, commodities like that. And so that picture has changed. And so what we're seeing now is an economy that's slowing down, an economy that is expected to grow at most 2% this year. Mm. And people, meanwhile, have higher expectations. We can't forget that during those boom years, that decade of boom, you know, many people moved into the lower rungs of the middle class. Credit was opened up here, so people were able to buy more things. And so along with that affluence, of course, comes people demanding better services. They want, you know, they want that trajectory to continue. And so there is a sense now that people are disappointed that Brazil's big moment really never arrived in the way that they'd hoped, and that it seems to have stalled for now.
Well, for now, they've got the World Cup there, and that's a pretty big moment. Lourdes Garcia Navarro, thanks for joining us to talk about it.
My pleasure.
Lourdes Garcia Navarro, she's an NPR South American correspondent. Coming up, we're going to talk about football, soccer in the United States and Central Ohio. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. The World Cup kicked off in Brazil last week. It's raised the profile of soccer around the world, as it is wont to do every few years, and especially here in the U.S., where soccer doesn't always get the attention that other professional sports enjoy. Joining us now to discuss the popularity of soccer in the U.S. and here in the Central Ohio area, Mike Malo. The Crew's Senior Vice President of Sales and Marketing. Also, Andrew Arthurs. He's Executive Director of Crew Juniors. That's the Crew's Youth Player Development Program. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And Mike Mala, welcome as well to you.
Thank you.
And also with us, Jim Sturm. He's the President of the Mid-Ohio Select Soccer League. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Thank you.
We were just listening to the Columbus Crew anthem. There's something about soccer anthems that are very forceful, very energetic, not sort of like we're familiar with say, football.
Yes, you know, there's a lot of musical elements to soccer, and you've probably seen some of it on the World Cup matches this past weekend. But at our matches, you know, people bring drums and instruments, and there's definitely a heartbeat, a drum beat, you know, among the fans, our supporters, that adds an element to the soccer experience that's unlike any other in the U.S.
The element of soccer, I guess, how much of a big deal does it mean when there's this huge soccer event halfway around the world? How much does it matter in Central Ohio?
Well, it matters a lot. The growth of the sport, the growth of the fan base, and really Columbus, we're the unofficial home of the U.S. team with as many, you know, FIFA World Cup qualifiers that they've played at Crew Stadium and have won and had success there, you know, including this past September when they beat Mexico and 2-0 again. So there's this legend of beating Mexico 2-0 in Columbus for several cycles now. And that sprung board the team to get their qualification into the World Cup. So there is a unique connection with Columbus and the U.S. national team. But as far as the growth of the sport, since the last World Cup cycle in 2010, the significance of growth, not just in Columbus, but across the league, there's been a 32% increase in Major League Soccer fans around the country. And that's been evident here in Columbus as well. We've seen a significant increase in the last 4 years.
Do you just measure fan base in terms of tickets sold to events? How do you measure?
We use Scarborough Research as a tool, and they measure it as people who have watched, attended, or listened to a match. And that's how they categorize the criteria.
And on that, I have a statistic here from the ESPN Sports Poll that for the first time in the 20-year history of that sports poll, Major League Soccer has caught up with Major League Baseball in one significant marker of popularity, and that is, will MLS become one of U.S.'s big four sports? And in that survey, both leagues claim 18% of the 21 to 17-year-old as avid fans of their sport, whereas 20 years ago, nobody knew soccer. Now, soccer is as popular as the often quoted America's pastime.
Right, which is losing fan base pretty quickly over time. But how much does that have to do with the kids? Andrew Arthurs?
Yeah, well, I think that the interest and the opportunities for kids locally but throughout the country has changed so dramatically from when we were growing up, or even 20 years ago when the World Cup was in hosted in the U.S., that it's amazing the access that the kids have to watch it throughout the globe. Certainly having an MLS team in our backyard here, so they can see that level, and then just all of the youth opportunities throughout Ohio, throughout the country. It's changed so dramatically over the last 20 years, and really even over the last 5 or 6 as well.
Jim Stern, how many kids are involved in Central Ohio?
We have in the State Soccer Association, which is the southern half of Ohio, we have approximately 30,000 registered players. There's probably that many more who also play on an unorganized basis, and that's just on the youth side. We have a lot of different organizations that provide that for the players.
You mean like rec leagues and that sort of thing?
There's rec leagues, there's competitive leagues. There's also a growing number of adult recreational leagues for the adults that played the sport as a youth and they want to stay with it. They're not professional. They're not going to be on the Crew's pitch, but they still enjoy the sport, and those are the ones that are the fans. And as Arthur alluded to, the ability for players to watch soccer throughout the world is a big also driving factor. We have the players that are going to practice on Monday night, and they're saying, wow, did you see the English Premier League game, Everton against Manchester? So 5 years ago, that conversation would have never taken place.
Because you couldn't see it.
You couldn't see it. But with the global reach of cable, it's making there are MLS teams, even if, you know, say the crew is off tonight, you can watch a Seattle LA game. You can watch lots of different games in a lot of different environments. That feeds the sport. That feeds the interest in the sport. And I actually think that it's the increase of the youth players' interest in the sport is what's actually driving the greater interest in the World Cup rather than the other way around. That because the kids are watching more, the players are the parents are watching more.
There's a few factors, I think, there. You know, you touched on the TV audience. There were over 4,000 soccer matches on TV in the U.S. last year. That's there were in 2010, there were 11 networks that carried soccer. In 2013, there were 21 networks that carried soccer matches. So 4,000 soccer matches, a lot of games to watch. And the U.S. has been one of the biggest growth markets for a lot of the European leagues. So now, you know, young consumers are able to watch these teams on TV. Plus, you got to add to that the EA Sports FIFA Soccer game, which is the number one game in the U.S. or the number one game in the world, second most popular in the U.S. So these kids are engaging in the sport through the game and get to know all these players and get to know what teams they play for, and these so they become more knowledgeable about the game around the world and have an appreciation for it because they can play these teams, play against these teams on their game, and then see them on TV. But I think, you know, playing the sport gives them an appreciation. And then what we've seen now is a generation of fans grow up with Major League Soccer. And so these fans are, you know, the crew has been around for 19 years, our 19th season, and they grew up. There's a generation now that are becoming of age to really be consumers of the sport in a different way. Ticket buyers, you know, supporting advertisers and those types of things.
There were a lot of naysayers back in the day. I know neither of you guys were around back then, but when they first built the stadium, maybe Jim, you remember that they just didn't think it would make it at all. They didn't think it would make it the last 2 or 3 years if they were lucky.
Well, the first 3 years, if people will remember, was actually played in OSU's football stadium. And it was pretty much recognized that, you know, the stadium seats 90,000, and if you were only going to have 10,000-15,000, that just wasn't going to work. So the local community, and certainly people have to remember how much former Mayor Greg Leshetka supported the early stages of the crew, they were able to come up with a cooperative venture, and the crew is rightly very proud of the fact that Crew Stadium was the very first soccer-specific stadium in the country. And I think that helped offer the league some credibility from the very beginning. You know, we were no longer using, in some cases, they actually played in high school stadiums. Well, you don't play a professional sport in a high school stadium. But having Crew Stadium here in the early stages of the MLS really said, hey, we're going to be here for a while. And that was actually a very, very significant point. And to this day, the Crew Stadium is, you know, they talk about the very first soccer-specific stadium in the country. Mm-hmm. And that's a remarkable thing for Columbus to claim.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about soccer in Central Ohio and the United States. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have an email from John. He writes, playing soccer in Grove City in 1974, my coach would conduct practice with a How to Coach Soccer guidebook in his hand. Since then, as Mr. Sturm could attest, soccer has grown such that Columbus and Ohio produce players who compete at the highest level, and it's a beautiful thing. How much does the fact that it's the first soccer-specific stadium that the city is, or the community, Central Ohio, has made this kind of commitment to the game of soccer, is that reflected in the caliber of players? Do we see that necessarily? Or are there plenty of other cities without soccer-specific stadiums that have just the highest quality, you know, of young players coming up?
Yeah, well, I think that, that Central Ohio and the state of Ohio have had some very, very good soccer coaches, clubs, systems, leagues for 15 or 20 years. So at the collegiate level, there's a number of programs that have done very well, high schools, clubs, the professional players produced before and now from our crew youth system. It's Ohio is certainly a soccer hotbed. And, you know, I think the resources and some of the expertise that we have here locally but throughout the state are different than what you'll find in most markets throughout the country.
Do any of you guys know how many soccer-specific stadiums there are in the United States now?
Boy, so I think we are coming up on 16.
I believe so.
Yeah,
I think
so,
it's 15 or 16. They just came out.
San Jose is under construction.
Okay.
So San Jose will have a new stadium. And then Orlando just broke ground. Orlando City is a new team coming in the league next year with New York City FC, who actually play at Yankee Stadium for their first year or so. So I think, yeah, I think it's 16 or 17 now.
Seattle and New England play in the NFL stadiums.
They do. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And then Atlanta.
Even Seattle. Okay.
Atlanta, when they come in the league in 2017, will also play, share a home with the Falcons.
But the one thing about Seattle, they almost need an NFL type stadium.
Because it's such, their fan base is gigantic.
I believe, you probably know, Mike, I think that they have averaged, what, 35,000?
38,000 a game this year they're averaging.
Compared to, say, Columbus?
We averaged just over 16,000 a game last year.
And you're happy with that?
16,000 is pretty good. You know, we'd love to be like Kansas City and Portland and Salt Lake, which are all very similar sized markets. And Portland and Kansas City have sold out every match last few years. So, they, you know, Kansas City, they have the advantage of a brand new stadium, and it's beautiful. And Portland, you know, just came into the league, you know, as the league was already established and had a really strong fan base. But they're all very similar sized markets. So we try to measure ourselves against those markets. And we've seen great growth. We've led the league in average attendance growth the last year. And then the year before that, we were second to Houston, who moved into a new stadium. So we're proud of the growth of the soccer fan in Columbus, and we're seeing it in other metrics. And I think, you know, it's just a rising tide, you know, raises all waters, and that's what we're seeing with our league. And I think the World Cup will also play a factor in that.
And John, in his email, referred to 1974, his coach using a How to Coach Soccer guidebook in his hands while he was conducting it. What kind of coaches are out there now compared to 20 or 30 years ago?
Well, 20 years ago, we had maybe 15, 20 former professional players that were doing a lot of the higher level coaching. The majority of the rest of them were just parents, much like myself, probably didn't play the sport in high school, but our kids wanted to play the sport, so we kind of picked it up as we went. Probably not the best way you want to learn to teach somebody something, but it was all that we had.
Right.
Now we're into the second, in some cases, third generation of soccer players who've had better coaching along the way, and who there's great coaching instruction that's out there, whereas more of the coaches are understanding that they don't know the sport, and coaches are seeking out additional training. And that is raising overall the quality of coaches. Now the next generation beyond this will do even better. And that's what we're looking for, always striving to improve. So there's a number of coaching classes out. There's a lot of good online instruction that makes it available for the players and to benefit by coaches with increased knowledge.
And how much does the crew, the Columbus crew, have a stake in that? To what extent does the organization extend itself into those ranks? Because, like we said earlier, most of those kids aren't going to play for the crew.
Yeah, I mean, we'd like to support and work with all youth organizations throughout Central Ohio and certainly Ohio as well, in some way, shape, or form. So it's important for us from a coaching education perspective that Jim just spoke about. I would agree that there's a lot more resources and a lot more standards and expectations that are being set by U.S. youth soccer and U.S. soccer now. There's just that's a priority that for us to improve the highest level. That really helping educate the folks at the grassroots level is
and
critical.
And that's not with soccer. That's with all sports now, that emphasis on youth.
Sure, absolutely.
Right?
I think you're seeing a lot more, you know, competitiveness at the youth level and a lot more specialization and sophistication of training. across a lot of different youth sports, and soccer is probably no different. Mm-hmm. I think soccer's just been at it a little bit longer, and I think what's interesting is the structure that comes down from U.S. Soccer, and Andrew can talk a little bit more about that. But U.S. Soccer is really, I think, taking a very systematic approach to how they align the standards and parameters and the coaching instruction and all that all the way down to, you know, every feeder system that feeds up into the U.S. Soccer development system. And I don't know, you can talk a little more about that, Andrew, and how that trickles down to every level throughout, you know, the communities throughout the country.
Yeah. And your others, yeah.
Sure. Over the last 7 or 8 years, Mike's right, U.S. Soccer, so the federation and the national teams have taken on a more of a leadership and a prominent role in youth soccer. And with the start of MLS youth systems in 2006, so the league has mandated that we all start our youth systems. It should be pretty obvious that the league, the MLS, and U.S. Soccer have some resources that they can really apply and help the game at all levels, but certainly at the grassroots level. And then to take that in conjunction and in concert with what U.S. Youth Soccer has been doing very well over the last 20, 25 years, that it's really trying to align all of the resources and make sure that everyone is pulling in the same direction with the right priorities and right standards.
Yeah, Jim Stern?
You mentioned some of the other sports. It is ironic, and I've seen some yard signs around where the NFL is apparently trying to mimic what the youth soccer program is doing, and the NFL is trying to develop their own youth leagues and everything
else.
Well,
they're losing about 10% of their players a year now in youth football.
And to be honest, part of that is the parents' concern about concussions.
Mm-hmm.
And with Ohio's new concussion law for youth players, on the soccer side, we're taking that very seriously and being very proactive to the best that we can to support the initiative set out by the legislature in that law. But it is kind of funny that NFL, which is the premier sport in the country, is now mimicking what soccer is doing because we're so successful, not to brag, but we're doing pretty good with the youth,
mm-hmm.
and they're trying to match what we do.
Andrew in Upper Arlington, you're on the air. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
Okay. I always listen to WOSU almost throughout the years and everything else, but
thank
I've noticed that the coverage on WOSU FM is almost non-existent.
Okay.
And I was just wondering why there seems to be a bias towards soccer. And that's all I'd like to know.
You mean a bias against it?
Well, yeah, because you give the scores of basketball, baseball games in Cincinnati, the Cleveland Cavaliers in Cleveland, all the Columbus sports at OSU and basketball and football. But there's never a weekly coverage of the MLS game or the Columbus Crew. And I've noticed that, and I've called in quite a few times, and no one really seems to care about soccer. And I think it's coming right up there, and it should be covered occasionally, at least with the scores or a brief rundown like the other sports are.
Okay. Yeah, you'd think. I don't know the answer to that question. They didn't put me in charge of the sports department.
Well, maybe
and
Mike Thompson or...
For a good reason. Yeah.
Brown might consider giving soccer just a fair shot because there's people out here that are interested, and we do like to donate to WOSU, but we're not seeing a fair shot, and I just don't think it's correct.
Well, I'm glad I had the show today, Andrew.
Okay, Ann.
And I'm glad you called.
Okay, my dear. Thank you. Have a good day.
Take care. You too.
Bye-bye.
What about the coverage of soccer from the media? You know, it's one thing to have it airing, but it's another thing to have it kind of inserted into your daily life, seeing it on the front page of the sports section or hearing the scores on, I mean, really, that's pretty much what WOSU does is the scores. But is there enough of that, or is there a frustration with the media when it comes to soccer?
Yeah, I do think that there's... You know, it depends on the market,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, I think that some of the media is slow to adopt, you know, you know, certainly not ESPN and certainly not some of the networks that are paying big dollars to acquire these soccer rights. So, you know, ESPN's coverage has been fantastic. ABC's coverage has been fantastic of the World Cup. But you know, throughout the year, are you seeing a lot of Major League Soccer highlights on ESPN? Now, I think you're going to see more of that in this new league TV contract that they have with ESPN. So it's just going to take a matter of time. As a professional sports team locally, you know, we would hope that, you know, anyone who's giving scores out that they would want to cover their pro soccer team in the marketplace to give a score of what happened that week. So, you know, I think that's just a matter of, for whatever reason, people are choosing to put what scores out there. But I think if you look at certain metrics, they are missing an audience by not giving someone like Andrew, who called in, you know, an opportunity to hear that score. He's going to go somewhere else to listen to find out what that score is. And so why miss that audience if you're a program director of a radio station? You know?
He's on vacation right now. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We'll be right back. Welcome back to All Sides. We are talking about soccer this hour. Although professional soccer is not as popular as some of the other pro sports with American fans, that may be changing, especially since the younger set, it is the most popular sport in many demographics. Average attendance rates at MLS games now rival those of the National Hockey League and the National Basketball Association, and youth soccer is an activity that millions of kids play every year. This hour, we're discussing the sport of soccer and its popularity in the United States. Still with us is Mike Malo. He's the Crew's Senior Vice President of Sales and Marketing. Also, Andrew Arthurs, Executive Director of Crew Juniors. That's the Crew's Youth Player Development Program. And also with us in the studio, Jim Sturm. He's President of the Mid-Ohio Select Soccer League. If you have a question or comment about soccer in Central Ohio in the United States, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Carl in Clintonville, you're on the air. Hi, Carl.
Thank you. I was interested in hearing an item, I think, on PBS over the weekend where childhood obesity is on the rise, as well as the popularity of youth soccer.
Huh. So what are you saying? Just a correlation.
I just, the two fit together, interesting juxtaposition there. I just thought I'd throw it out.
All right, Carl. Soccer's a very rigorous sport, though, a very active sport, right? You know, you're not just sitting around going over, you have to be in incredible physical shape. I remember I was taking my niece to a boot camp, and I said, "What'd you think?" She goes, "That was really good. That was really hard." But we do that for 5 or 6 hours a day. She's a college soccer player. I couldn't believe it, but I don't doubt her. She's never told me a lie yet. So the rigors, he brought up a correlation.
Not every kid plays soccer, you know, but there's certainly a lot of them. And it does require a certain amount of athletics and endurance to play. And it's a great exercise sport. So I would think if more kids played soccer, we'd maybe affect that even more. But
I believe there's a statistic in a professional game, the average player runs 6 miles. Is that the right number? 6 miles in 90 minutes. I'm pretty sure that's a lot more than football and baseball players do. And so from an athletic point of view, it is certainly a very strenuous program. Also, with, unlike some of the other sports, you have a lot of players on the field at any one time. You don't have a lot of players sitting on the bench, as in you have in some of the other sports. So you have a lot of kids who are working a lot of the time in that 90 minutes of play. So it is an extremely athletic position. It takes a number of different athletic skills to play it effectively.
Yeah, I would agree. Certainly at the top level, the athleticism, all you need to do is turn on ESPN or ABC and watch the World Cup and what those players do at the world-class level. But even the youth kids that are in our system or in Jim's league, that it's a great activity for sure that I think is difficult to match in other sports in terms of getting out and being active.
Is there any frustration at all that they're niched out too soon? There's so much competition between the sports. You're going to go into football, you're going to go into hockey, you're going to go into soccer. And soccer still doesn't have the scholarships that, say, a football and basketball do, and hockey to a certain degree.
Yeah, I think for us in our system, unless you're at a certain age and a certain level where you need to specialize, that we would encourage you to do to participate and try other things, get other perspectives, be active, and then again as you progress up into the system, then and you can specialize a little bit more. You know, for those top players, there's a need for that more consistent and year-round training.
And also some sports actually complement soccer, for instance, track or cross country. Mm-hmm. Those are both endurance sports. Those benefit players because it increases their endurance, which is certainly a benefit on the field. The other thing is, the one thing about sports, and soccer certainly is among this, one of the reasons that we want to encourage youth to do it is not only just for the sport itself, but it's also the other benefits, learning teamwork, sportsmanship, commitment. Those are the kinds of things that soccer, as well as the other sports, help promote in young people and help promote character and all those other things that we want to see from our young people going forward in their lives.
Len in Lewis Center, you're on the air. Hi, Len.
Well, howdy, Ann. I play a little soccer in the Army, and I've seen all these problems with the headshots, the headers, mm-hmm. and I think it's maybe time to make headers illegal in youth soccer, and then maybe work it over the years, work it up into high school and maybe even college soccer, and then eventually into pro soccer. It would take a worldwide effort, but I think it would be very much worthwhile because soccer is such a great sport, but that's a real downer, getting a terrible head trauma.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Len. Thanks for that call. Of course, that's where you're hitting the ball with the head. It's popular, but how do you direct children when it comes to that move?
It gets back to something we talked a bit ago about, and that is coaches' education. Headers should be taught properly, and there's a right way and there's a wrong way, and coaches' education can go a long way toward doing that. As far as whether a lot of heading the ball during the sport leads to issues is actually an open question. It's been studied, and you guys may know more of the studies, but it's inconclusive at this point. There's some talk about having the players wear headgear during a game.
Mm-hmm.
There's some speculation and some studies that suggest that actually make it worse because then the players are willing to take more risk.
So, like they've suggested is the case with football.
Right. The football helmet, when they had leather helmets, they didn't dive in with their head. Mm-hmm. Now that they have the hard helmets, they're diving in with their head, which mm-hmm. causes more problems. So it is something that the entire soccer community is aware of. And they're paying attention. There's participated in lots of studies. But to outlaw heading right now at this point, I'm not sure it makes a lot of sense because it's, as I said, the correlation between heading and brain injury is still an open question.
Yeah, I think I would agree that it's a pretty significant part of the game. And I think that the proper technique and also how to protect yourself when you're in the air and to make sure that the timing is right and so on. And some of the gear that Jim referenced, I think that those are the things that are out there today. But no question, if you watch the World Cup, the guys up in the air are, you know, taking some shots and are certainly vulnerable.
We have an email from Margie. She says, please mention that Columbus has a team in the Women's Premier Soccer League. The Columbus Eagles play at Wellington High School, and their next game is Sunday, June 29th at 2 p.m. Okay, Margie. She says, I am a longtime Crew season ticket holder and think we need to support the women players, too. I was going to bring up that issue. Women's professional soccer folded a few years ago.
That's not really true. There still is a league much smaller than
much
it
smaller.
Used to be.
Right.
I believe there's seven teams.
It's the NWSL, Women's National Women's Soccer League. They are actually affiliating with Major League Soccer teams and the Portland Thorns. They're actually drawing, you know, 9,000-10,000 fans a game, which is fantastic. Houston launched their own team, and you know, some of the women that are very popular on the women's U.S. national team are playing on these teams, and having great success. And so it's great to see the women's game, you know, at the professional level start to come around. Now you have, I think, you know, like what's happening in Columbus with some of the feeder, you know, lower league teams, you know, finding ways to make a business model out of it.
There is the, as the caller mentioned, there is the Columbus Eagles play at Wellington mm-hmm. High School. This is their first year. They belong to a best described as a semi-professional where it is made up of, there's actually a couple of high school players, some current college players, a number of former college players. They've just put together this first season. I know that they've played already in Indianapolis, and they've played one home game, and it's starting to catch on. Would encourage people to go to those games. Wellington's a great field there, great complex there in Upper Arlington for them to enjoy the women's game, which, as the father of three daughters, I will readily recognize, is a slightly different game than the men's game. And, Andrew, you've also worked with the women.
How is the women's game different?
There's probably twice as many passes in a women's game as there in a men's game.
Yeah, so typically not as physical, but the technique of a lot of the top female players and the style of play is very, very good. And for whatever reason, since we first won the World Cup in 99, the professional level just hasn't necessarily taken. But we love to see some of the success stories that Mike mentioned. We love to see that and hope that we can grow that side of the game here locally as well.
Bill in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I'd like to thank you for giving me a chance to get in a few words in edgewise. I'd like to compliment you on the great program.
You know what, Bill? You have to turn down your radio.
They've got the TV on. Let me...
Well, okay. We're on television too, folks. Yeah, you got to turn down whatever you're listening to because it's echoing and it's confusing you.
Yes, yeah. I did, yes.
Okay, all right.
I'd just like to stress the fact that, you know, first of all, you're doing a great job. This is necessary, programs like this.
Thanks,
to
Bill.
Wake up the people. You know, what a great service soccer is and your program. Soccer, you know, helps the kids to stay healthy. We have a healthier population. We have better students. Everything, you know, is better. And yet, right now is the World Cup. And I only saw on Channel 5 one soccer game, and not exactly what I wanted to see, but nothing else afterwards. I have to watch the Hispanic Channel, 61-1 in Cleveland, to get anything. And my Spanish is not fluent or good. It's poor to fair.
Okay, so your criticism or you're suggesting that there's not enough English speaking or English speaking coverage of the World Cup is he may not have
if he doesn't have you
cable.
Know, well, I think with now everyone has to have some type of cable connection with everything going digital. But depending on what package you have, but you know, ESPN and is the major carrier of the World Cup games. ABC is airing a few games on the weekends.
And they are all English. I mean, far as I haven't seen any non-English, unless I go to a non-English channel.
Right.
Well, that is one unique thing about soccer as opposed to most of the other sports. You don't need to listen to the game to enjoy it. You can turn the sound off and just watch the game without the announcer. Some of the other sports, you have to have everything explained, whether the fouls or whatever. You don't need to understand the language to enjoy the sport while it's on the field. And so that's certainly an advantage with the increasing changes in the demographic population of the country. That helps as well because you don't have to understand English or Spanish or whatever to enjoy the game as shown on TV.
Anything to add to that? You know, soccer is very popular among new immigrants from Mexico, South America. Do you work to nurture that part of the fan base, too? I mean, that Mexico-USA game must have been one way to do it. But is that something that is on your agenda?
Yes. You know, the Latino marketing is always part of our strategic planning. And ironically, right before I came over here, I got a a memo from one of the executives at Major League Soccer who you know, outlined some key demographics that's going to be part of you know, really the future with next year celebrating the 20th season for the league and for the Crew. We're outlining some initiatives to really, you know, by 2022 is what the league has established as the date where, you know, there's some metrics that we want to accomplish. And one is the quality of our play on the field and our league being the consideration of choice among soccer fans in the country. And part of that is attracting a Hispanic fan base. So we're focused on that.
All right. Mike Malo, Crew Senior Vice President of Sales and Marketing, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Also from the Crew, Andrew Arthur is Executive Director of Crew Juniors. That's their youth player development program. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Jim Sturm, he's president of the Mid-Ohio Select Soccer League. Jim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having all of us.
And thanks to everybody for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.